This is Counterculture with Marie Buskey, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. on Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. Joining me now for Media Matters, Marty Gibson. How are you, Marty?
I'm good, thanks, Marie. I'm, a bit rainy here. I've had shingles.
I know.
I accidentally posted a photo of the group chat. You were kind enough to alert me to.
I know. It was the funniest thing.
So it was almost a relief.
As listeners may not be surprised to hear that Marty is the master of the meme. You are our official RCR meme collector, and you were supplying us with our fix of memes. And as I was going through having my little chuckle of memes, then I get half a naked Marty with butt crack. Ooh, I think I should text Marty. I don't think that was intended.
I said it could have been so much worse. And yeah.
Oh, I'm sure there are some out there that would have loved to have seen that. But anyway, I digress. Family show and all of that. I had a busy weekend. I had my event on this weekend, my annual event. 15 years I've been doing this thing. Couldn't believe it.
Right.
I know. Knitters. I got to meet the lovely Liz from Inbox in person.
Oh, that would be awesome.
It was.
She's a cheery in person this year.
She's lovely. She's so lovely. Yeah.
We're so lucky with the support people. And, you know, I've always think, and I know you do too, we mention them now and then, but they make this happen.
Totally.
And they're so professional. They're so cheerful, so supportive. It's a great team. I've got to say, Reality Check Radio is probably, in as much as it is in a work environment, it's certainly been one of my favourite work environments ever.
Yeah, and it's incredible how we can gather that all working remotely. And also one of my contributors, Annie Hart, was there as well. So it was great. And meeting someone for realsies does make a difference. You know, in Queenstown, I caught up with Rodney and Dave and our editor, Reese, and it does make
nice
a difference.
Nice one, Dave. Ooh, you're a legend, Dave.
Yeah, it was cool. It was very cool.
Quite the Flight of the Conchords.
Big weekend for both of us. However, we did wade back into the cesspit of what was going on in media. The thing is that I grabbed the papers late Sunday and did the sift, absolutely shattered after a four-day event. I have to say, I think I need the newspaper diet because there wasn't a lot there, and what was there gave me the shits. So,
well,
you know.
I know you like a good food analogy, Marie, and the way I think of it is that when you've got access to information from Telegram, X, and of course Reality Check Radio, consuming New Zealand's mainstream media is a bit like picking at reheated fish and chips after you've just eaten a really good buffet. The reheating's never as good as the original information, which wasn't that good in the first place. And after more nourishing fare, it makes one a bit nauseous having to consume it. I did find that I'd sort of read a little bit, and I just thought, you're just lying to me.
I know, actually, it is like that over-fatty, soggy, soggy chip.
You're being obtuse.
Well, let's start with the sort of one little spark, actually, which was, and it was covered quite a bit across the week last week, was the local government conference. I mean, you couldn't write the script. I mean, they're going to have the conference in the very, very expensive conference centre in Wellington. A piper bursts outside, and then Christopher Luxon stands up and proceeds to deliver the woodshed chat of all woodshed chats to everyone inside.
Yeah, seeing him get that little proto-spine was quite exciting. And it's quite funny him saying, I've only got 10 minutes, so be blunt. And, you know, then there followed all of the drag queens and the various other bits of distraction and fluff that got them into that mess in the first place.
So when that happened on Wednesday, I was here, I had, for the event, because Knitters, right, I had one of my knitting ladies over for knit night, as you do, and she is a middle to senior manager at council, one of the councils here, and there was lots of pinging on her phone around the speech that had transpired that afternoon. Her politics and I are not aligned, I think that's safe to say. However, she's a very smart girl and she's you know, she's very exceptionally diligent. I'm very fond of the school. Anyhow, I asked her, do you think that that speech, whilst addressed to everyone in the room, do you believe that it may have been a little bit more pointed to the mayor of the host of the city that they were in? And yeah, she did look at me and wonder, and that did actually get touched by Heather Duplessis-Allen in her column on, was this actually a bit of a swipe at Tory whānau?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was, and Tory whānau herself wrote a column, but yeah, Heather Duplessis-Allen's.
She wrote here, notoriously a big spender, Wellington's Mayor Tory whānau accused the Prime Minister of punching down as if he was picking on her, the mayor of our capital city. Oh, Tory, you got the memo. It's so good. Anyway, Greater Wellington Regional Councillor Thomas Nash tweeted that the speech was one of the most mana-diminishing, paternalistic and visionless speeches to a group of people I've ever heard. Now, drum roll, please. No prizes for guessing what party he affiliates with. Mm.
Heather Duplessis-Allen's so good when she's being waspish. And that quote was preceded by what Luxon probably didn't bank on, was how easily these mayors and councillors would hand him the win when they immediately started whinging like spoilt children stopped from helping themselves to the contents of daddy's wallet unsupervised. And then, yeah, after that, she said she was saying it was about he and his mates feels, while completely forgetting how that sounds to the ratepayers he and his council had just slapped with a 30 to 55% rate rise. So, yeah, it's... good slapping there from Heather.
Well, and the other thing too she brought up as well is the one major council that is not representative because they pulled themselves out of this group, which is the Local Government New Zealand group, is Wayne Brown's Auckland. Mm. And see, in comparison to what did they say, the average, I think the average rate rise was around 20-22%. For most New Zealanders, it was quite high. It might have been high teens, but it was a lot.
I know. Well, she was saying in that 20 to 55%.
Yeah, rate rise massive. The Auckland, by comparison, 6.8%, which is vastly more palatable. Now, Wayne Brown has been vastly criticised by many for, well, his Wayne Brownness. You've spoken about it before. You know the man. Your father's worked with him. He's a guy, he fixes things and he really doesn't care what people think of him.
Yeah. Yeah. I've worked a lot with crusty old engineers and I've got a great amount of affection for them, even though they're not people who naturally inspire it. It's just how capable they are, how much they know, and how hard won so much of that knowledge is. And when I hear people writing them off, you know, whether it's the pale, stale male epithet or whatever, I always feel that they're missing the point.
And then meanwhile, Claire Trevitt, actually, I think she was begrudgingly impressed with Luxon's speech. Usually she's a little bit more asinine about what she has to say, but she said Luxon did not bother to sugarcoat it because his audience was not the people in the room. It was the people outside the room, the ratepayers, a fair few of whom would have been cheering him on. He railed against the laundry list of distractions and experiments councils had spent money on. And you know what? I think that that's what it comes down to. I think there are a lot of people that have been elected on 3-year cycles who, at the end of the day, a politician is a politician is a politician, whether it be local government or central government. They're there on 3-yearly cycles. They want to appease the voters on usually a single or particular platform, and often it will be something based around a nice to have, not a need to have. And I guess no one's ever going to get voted on the sexiness of upgrading your sewer system or your wastewater pipes, are they?
Well, I think when people are suffering, and you know, we've got to remember the average Kiwi mortgage went up by something like $1,000 a month over the past few years. Mm. People are really, really squeezed. They didn't have that much discretionary income to start with. And so when they see people who are in part at least to blame for their suffering seeming oblivious to it, it does inspire a certain kind of rage. And conversely, it inspires a certain amount of affection when people do recognize it and seem willing to do something about it. So I think, yeah, it was uniquely a good bit of reading the room by old Luxon.
Mm. I also love this other comment that Trevor pointed out. Others railed that having the government decide what council should spend money on was a step too far. And I have to admit, I can concur with it. You know, I think there needs to be a certain element of local autonomy there. They are the ones tasked with looking after us in our own patch, right? The Green Party described it as imposing austerity on the council, saying it was an assault on local democracy. The PM called rude and patronising, whilst Labour leader Chris Hipkins went a bit personal in the apparent reference to Luxon's wealth, saying it was all well and good for people who could afford their own pools and books, but not so great if you couldn't. Talk about a pot meat kettle.
Yeah, well, and then she goes on to say Luxon would not have given a fig. As far as he was concerned, in the court of public opinion, it was a win for Luxon.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, and I think this is where the media is so often coming down on the wrong side of Kiwis, because Kiwis aren't their customers. I've just been astonished at how nasty the cartoons are, and not actually that funny. Like, there's a cartoon on this one that shows Simeon Brown as a rat, saying great shot, boss, when he's hit, you know, a large target, which is council spending, sort of diminishing again the very real difficulties that Kiwis are having eating, heating their homes, staying in their homes, just paying to stay alive, let alone actually doing anything that makes their life richer. And these are the same people who cheered on Squealer Robertson and his merry band of Marxist student politicians who got us into this mess. So,
well, that actually segues quite nicely, and I know that you probably only just skimmed it because I just whipped it to you because you don't get the paper up there, which is the Post. Thank goodness for small mercies, I say. But anywho, Janet Wilson, Labour can't pivot to win in 2026 with Hipkins at the helm. The sharks are circling. The rumour mill that he's going to get rolled by Kieran McNulty is it's a pretty open secret. You're starting to see these stories. There was another story.
The man with the creepiest stare in New Zealand politics.
Yeah.
He gives me the creeps. That guy. That really makes me worry is when I just don't get things. I just didn't get Jacinda Mania. It was like, can't you see?
Who do you find creepy, McNulty or Hipkins? Jerry
McNulty.
Right. Okay. So you don't get
the way he's got that kind of wide-eyed, predatory, unblinking kind of stare, like he's about to eat the person he's talking to. Just kind of sends a shiver down my spine.
Right.
I don't know. The whole "I'm a socialist" kind of thing. I always feel pretty skeptical of men who say that. It's sort of, it always strikes me as, oh yes, I'm an ally. Have another glass of Chardonnay.
It's interesting.
It's a cuttlefish mating technique, you know, where the little weak cuttlefish tuck up their tentacles to pretend to be chick cuttlefish and then sneak under the dominant men and then sneakily mate with them. So I always think it's that kind of thing.
Janet Wilson says in her piece, it's called Labour Can't Pivot to Win in 2026 with Hipkins at the helm. Because that collective grumpiness is less about politics, and this is talking about the killjoy policies, making beneficiaries' lives harder, reinstituting three strikes and legislation on banning gam patches. That's what she picked. I think people are more worried about feeding their families and heating their homes than that, but let's move on. Because that collective grumpiness less about politics than about the pain of the economy was exerting, a pain that's now set for some relief with a series of OCR cash rate cuts, which is good news for National, less so for Labor. So what does the future look like for the Workers' Party next year and then the next election? And I was like, what, Janet? The Workers' Party? That's a 20th century bubble you're living in, darling. I mean, the 21st century, sweetheart, that's what we're living in. It's the party of shiny bottom civil servants, laptop lifestyles, and wannabe woke Karens. I think she needs to get with the program on that. She's living in La La Land, as far as I'm concerned, if she thinks that Labour is still the party of workers.
It's kind of a bit of a gay sauna as well.
She did actually kind of come to that a little bit later on. Like, I think she realises that's the case. Funny you should mention that. Which brings us to the other rather large pachyderm in the room, she says. The ideological tension between Labour's factions. Across Helen Clark's 9 years in power and the Jacinda Ardern six, Labour ruled by adopting the centrist third-way politics of Tony Blair and Bill Clinton. Those further to the left were kept at bay with blandishments about the incremental change and the need to retain the faith of the electorate. Labour activists, it seems, have had enough. Writing this week in the left-wing newspaper The Standard, Elliot Crossan, chair of the Eco-Socialist Campaign Group, God, I bet they're fun at parties, System Change Aotearoa, opined that the fact Hipkins was still leader showed that Labour doesn't intend to change. Activists will not tolerate this, he said. It's incredibly unlikely that Labour will ever return to being a socialist party of the working class, he wrote. An alternative to the Labour Party must emerge.
I can't help but read that as doubt they'll ever return to being a socialist party of the working class. You've got to put a lisp in there. Same with racism. Just sounds better.
So then here's the question. If you are somebody who's on the margins, who is a working class or blue-collar worker, who does represent you in New Zealand politics today?
You'd have to say New Zealand First. It's probably pretty up there in terms of their efforts to stimulate local economies. And I think just generally, just goes to show how terribly national-sold their tax cuts, that they're still called tax cuts rather than readjustments of margins or whatever. You know, the tax on New Zealanders with lower incomes had been increased by inflation. I think, you know, talking about the third way of Tony Blair and Bill Clinton, I mean, that they were working for the corporations. And the fact that that's not widely acknowledged by the left, or it is to a large extent, but by some of the more intellectual types, the dwindling number of them on the left, the Chris Trotters. But I think possibly a fourth way is needed, where you make it easier for working class people to start their own businesses. I think that's the future of people being able to earn a dignified amount of money by working.
Well, again, beautiful segue as always, my friend, because have you been keeping up to date with this Uber court case?
No, a bit about it. I know that they never make any money. And tell me. Do go on.
So there has been a court case. It's now just been heard at the Court of Appeal. There have been four drivers with the assistance of the union. And the last photograph that I saw in this morning's Herald, the image showed the picket line, and the photograph was taken earlier this year. And you could see visibly at the front of the picket line Tuiana Tuiono and Lawrence Yunnan from the Green Party. So it gives you an idea, if you step back, the political push behind this. It's more than just the unions, but that whole Marxist upward-facing fist. So these four drivers have taken Uber to task that they aren't actually contractors to Uber. They fit the criteria of employees. Now, initially, they won the case. Anyway, went to the Court of Appeal. These four drivers have won it again. Uber are now going to be taking it to the Supreme Court. It's not so much that particular case, but it's the knock-on effect of where do you draw the line between what is a contractor and what is an employee? And both you and I know that when it comes to creating and setting up new businesses, having a lot of businesses use contractors, I mean, our building trade absolutely survives on contractors and subbies and short term, because, you know, employment isn't always a static thing. It's often fluid. So that's where contractors fill that gap, that fluid gap. The wide range implications on this are massive. And I just can't help think to myself, is this another ideological green and union driven push which is going to have a massive butterfly effect that they're counting on to everybody under control?
Like when they insisted that people working in IHC workshops get paid minimum wage, suddenly all these people who loved going to their jobs didn't get paid that much, don't have a job. That high-minded moralism that's always counterproductive. I mean, you know, if we looked at what we do for RCR, it's an offer and acceptance thing. I'm very happy with it, with whatever we do get as a consideration for our time.
And it's mutually consentable too, between us and the team.
I want the freedom to be able to do that. I don't want to give anyone any ideas about how to shut it down. The problem with jacking up the minimum wage all the time is that you end up not being able to pay your best workers what they're worth, because you're having to pay your worst workers more than they're worth. And so your best workers quickly get disillusioned and drop their productivity, and your worst workers have got no incentive to pick their feet up a bit. I want to get too ranty and off media on this, but yeah, so many of these laws are made by people who've never had to make money off of managing someone to do tasks. Some people go better than others. They're not widgets. No. And if you want to look at New Zealand's productivity problem in a nutshell, it's when you talk to a builder and you say, how are you going? And I mean, they're not saying this so much at the moment, but, you know, some periodically they say, oh, I'm just so flat out. And always make a point of saying, well, why don't you hire someone? And they just wince like you've punched them in the guts, you know? Oh, God, I couldn't. Nah, it's too much hassle. That right there is a problem. You've got someone who's highly skilled and is doing menial tasks that are detracting from his own productivity because it's too much hassle to hire someone to do it. Because once they hire them, maybe they won't be able to get rid of them. Maybe they'll get tangled up in some legal crap if they get the hire wrong. Yeah, those labor laws need really revisiting. And there's going to be people with big fat tums and soft hands and skinny arms who are going to whine, but they're the sort of people who you accidentally hire.
Well, the thing that concerns me about this whole Uber thing is, I mean, even if you just look at the Uber situation, right? Most Ubers that I get, either new arrivals to New Zealand or there are a lot of retirees. I don't know what it's like over in Tauranga, but here I'll often catch an Uber here in the Bay and they're people who are in their 60s usually. They've retired, but they just want to do something, you know, a little bit in between. Yeah, meet some people, be a bit social. They tend to do the day shifts. And so I will quite often catch them if I'm going to the airport, which is where I most likely take an Uber from, or if I'm doing something out for lunch and there's a couple of beverages of the alcoholic persuasion involved, well, then, you know, I'll use an Uber.
That's very responsible, yes.
Well, yeah, yes, very.
It's not the 80s anymore.
Well, and see, that is my concern, because that was one of the beautiful things about Uber, is that it allowed you an option that was reasonably priced to get you either, if you drove somewhere, you could leave your car if it was in a safe location and get home, and it's not a big deal. Like, you could get home, you think, oh, you know, $20 versus creating an accident, losing my license, DOC or what have you.
I'm not doing that again.
Well, I've never done it, but you know what? But then if you make that expensive, I mean, will that force people to make poor decisions, to drive when they shouldn't be driving? What about all of those people? I know a number of people in the larger cities use Uber because public transport is good to get you from main arterials from A to B. But if you don't have brilliant mobility, you may not be able to walk from your bus stop to wherever it is that you live. So therefore, an Uber for you is a perfectly reasonable option. That gets taken off the table because all you're doing by forcing this issue is adding cost to everything across the board. They then add rules. So does this mean if you become an employee of Uber, you're now no longer, I mean, will they put in rules saying, well, you can't moonlight, or what happens with secondary tax, people that drive Uber to supplement their income with other jobs? There's so many levels of consequence with this. And that's even before you get to the precedent that it sets for other contractors. This is an absolute Pandora's box that I don't think everyday people are aware the gravitas of this decision.
Yeah, the law of unintended consequences. I mean, you know, it's also, and just getting back to that minimum wage thing with young people, you know, if you've got to pay a young person $20 an hour, you just get them doing something menial. You can't take the time to really teach them to do anything. And no one stays on minimum wage forever, like, if they're doing it right. And, you know, for a person who's maybe 17 or 18 and living with their folks, getting experience and learning something's worth more than the cash. So yeah. Just blow it on Vs and video games.
Oh, yeah, indeed. Anyway, well, it's not V's anymore, I'm told. It's Monsters. These are so 1990s, Marty.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. We're behind the eight ball, my friend. What else have you got on your list this morning?
As usual, I've got a whole stack of paper. I mean, you know, getting back to that should he stay or should he go chippy conversation. Matthew Hooton wrote about that, and I've seen there's been a bit of pushback in subsequent papers with Labour supporters saying, it's a trap. Matthew Hooton giving us advice. He's basically saying that underneath, they just need to exfoliate off Hipkins and Megan Woods, and there's this great replenished, fresh-looking heir apparents who are ready to rule. And he suggested that the slight bump in the polls Labour got, which was a simple shuffling of a percentage from the very unstable green raft to the to the clunky old lifeboat of Labour. But yeah, Hooton seems to think Kieran McAnulty is a leader in waiting with a communication style very different from Ardern, Hipkins or Luxon. Had he been in charge of Three Waters under the last government all along, it would not have gone off the rails. That's possibly true. With him able to communicate, too late as it turned out, that it was about pipes, not appointment committees. I mean, I tended to think it was just about appointment committees. So, yeah, no, he praises Barbara Edmonds, the new finance spokesman, as a fiscal conservative in the best tradition of Sir Michael Cullen, and is impressing in the business and finance communities as well as the party. She has greater technical knowledge of accounting, finance and economics than Nicola Willis or almost anyone else in Parliament. He over-eggs the pudding further on where he says, Damien O'Connor could easily do another term as Trade and Agriculture Minister, and David Parker as the indispensable policy reform expert to ensure a McAnulty government left a greater social democratic legacy than the failed Ardern-Hipkins outfit. Others with more to offer include Pene Henare, Deborah Russell, and Aisha Verrill. So, yeah, it just shows how good it is having different ideas about things.
Mm.
Yeah, good having that angle.
Yeah, actually, the other idea that cropped up with that was Bat Robson, sort of, while we're still in that slight vein, he was talking about KiwiBank because there was shots were fired across the bow by Luxon, but also by Nicola Willis to the profits taken by the banks. And of course, there's, the Australian banks, the power companies, there's New Zealanders' rich pickings for them. You know, they're able to jack the prices up. Everything here just costs more. And in banking, she fired shots across the bow. And of course, Robson was right in ground floor with KiwiBank all the way back in the day. He was putting his jukes up to sort of defend KiwiBank because that's what it's there for. I mean, it can be a spoiler in this situation. What did he say? 1 million Kiwis and 40,000 businesses are banking with KiwiBank. You know, it's not insignificant. You know, that's 20% of the country have an account there. And then there was another article around break fees. People are discovering now that things are starting to shift and those locked into those very expensive high fixed rates are looking at potentially bitter competition is now coming in, and one family were facing $15,000 worth of break fees if they were to leave ASB and go elsewhere.
Yeah, they get their pound of flesh. It was interesting, speaking of numeracy, Lester Levy, there was the article in the New Zealand Medical Journal that concluded Health New Zealand Te Whatu Ora's vote health operational budget did not increase by 6.2 this year, but rather only 0.4. Lester Levy just took them to school, and you can really see reading this, although it is a little bit wonky. You know what I mean? It's quite detailed, and it's, you can tell he's got a fair amount of intellectual horsepower. It's not necessarily a politician's column, but he basically gives them a good kicking about how they got their interpretation of it entirely wrong. And he's saying the actual increase is 15.5 times what they'd said because they'd confused all sorts of things within the budget. But it was interesting to read his conclusion and refreshing as well because you think, man, he actually could be the guy who sorts this out. He said, the health sector has only a very modest record of productivity gains, and consequently there is considerable potential to lift productivity within the current system, not by working harder, but by working differently. evidence from OECD reveals that up to 20% of health expenditure could be directed to more effective use and thereby better health outcomes. And therefore, a value-based approach to healthcare has the potential to seize greater control over the cost curve into the future. My focus is on making sure we get the best value for patients from the significant investment made by the public in our health system. And that includes faster, safer access for patients and more rewarding experiences for our staff. We are already getting more funding for Health New Zealand. We now need to make sure we get more value. Isn't that refreshing to hear?
Because so your general vibe on him is pretty good?
Well, yeah, again, my understanding of him comes through my father, who worked with him and said he's got a mind like a steel trap. Mm. He came over to our place for dinner a couple of times. A really personable guy, very smart, whip smart. And I guess sticking with health, and there's that article, flu season set to stretch into spring. As I mentioned, I got shingles, which is really, you know, I'd never get sick. I've never been as sick as I've been this year. And, you know, I'm not one to jump on every passing mandatory experimental gene therapy. So there is some speculation that it spreads from our more gullible compatriots. But, that was an interesting to hear the health sector just scratch their heads. Oh, what could it be? We expect these illnesses at this time of the year, but there does seem to be more influenza around this year than in the last couple. And they conclude, getting immunized against influenza, which remains free for everyone aged 65 and over, pregnant people.
Yeah, I know they knotted my knickers, but anyway, continue.
And many others, provides good protection against various strains of flu that are currently circulating. And health experts have suggested COVID could again claim more lives than flu in 2024, although the toll could be slightly lower than the 1,300 plus deaths reported last year.
So are they now actually deciding to differentiate the difference between COVID and flu? Because they sure as sugar weren't doing that in 2020. There was no flu in 2020.
And you know, getting back to that point I made at the opening about mainstream media being a bit like eating reheated fish and chips after you've been listening to Reality Check Radio. I listened to Paul Brennan interviewing Guy Hatchard on Monday, and he made a couple of salient points that Stats New Zealand have stopped publishing weekly death figures. They're busy hiding them. Why is the big question. The number of people who are unable to work due to disability, though, they're still releasing, and that increased by 8.2% in the year to June 2024. So something's going on there.
Disability, that's what Ed Dowd talks about, because he said the death numbers were quite binary, but he said those disability numbers, where you have people that are still in the population but can't contribute to it as working members, he said that number is skyrocketing in the US. 8.2, so 8.2 is the increase.
Mm.
The
other thing that Guy Hatchard made is, we don't have stats on cancer or heart disease. Some leaked data suggests heart disease has doubled. Excess deaths are down, but still up on historic trends. And the government's still saying the health crisis is because of administrative inefficiency. They're still hiding deaths from vaccine status. Yeah, this is where, and I don't know if you've picked this up as well, but we're getting to a very pointy juncture in history, aren't we, with the election coming up in the States. And I'm just seeing all of this gaslighting about how much New Zealanders love Kamala. Again, I just don't get it.
Heckles, that's what I call her.
Just such an unlikable person. You're seeing, like, again on X, you can see some of the disorder that's coming about as a result of these corporations lobbying. We started with Tony Blair to flood these Western countries with immigrants from countries with much, much higher murder rates. So whereas England had 1.8 per 100,000, they're importing people, you know, from countries with 50 per 100,000, like Jamaica. And, yeah, there's all of these horrible videos on X of, you know, well, I saw one man the other day just walking along with his wife and pushing a pram, and some guy stabs him in the neck. The insipid reporting of that.
Well, it's not only the insipid reporting, but it's also to any sort of information that isn't completely curated and controlled. I mean, with the American elections, I saw again on X, it was a survey of the trust of Americans and their voting tendencies of what their trust in the media was like. And it, I mean, this was interesting. Both independents and Republicans were trending down. Republicans sat at about 20% trust in legacy media. The independents were down to about a third. And lo and behold, the Democrats, since 2016, their trust in the media, legacy media, has skyrocketed. Well, that tells you that. So that explains your Kamala theory, because
Get very left-wing media, and we're probably to the left of most Democrats here.
Yeah.
And in New Zealand, the people who most trust the media, women who vote Labour.
Yeah. And if you were to read Matthias Desmet's Psychology of Totalitarianism, he talks about those that sit within a mass, and a mass can move and change and be quite fluid, but there are that group that sit in that mass who are completely sold into that hypnosis, and the media is the swinging watch that keeps them hypnotized, and whatever is said on one news goes. They will believe that hook, line, and sinker. And yet, by alternative, you've got places like X and Telegram. And did you see the French arrested the co-founder of Telegram? Because
the co-founder of Telegram, that other guy's yacht sank after his partner died in a car crash. Yeah.
The Telegram one is particularly interesting. And the chap from Rumble, I mean, they've been circling around him too. And the warning is like, you need to be careful and get out, because they are wanting to shut down anything that doesn't fit to their very cozy, clear, defined narrative. They hate conversation. They hate people talking to each other. I mean, that's why those lockups were so fantastic, wasn't it? It kept us all siloed away from each other. None of those little chats. They don't talk to each other. Heaven forbid. We don't want you to do that. Mm. I mean, it is really quite concerning. And then, of course, actually, just while we're on, we've transitioned to international now. I spoke with Cam, you know, about why RFK, we don't talk about him more.
Yeah.
And he's now sort of chucked his hat, and particularly in those battleground states behind Donald Trump. So he's still saying on the ballot, in the clear red and blue states as an independent, but in those battlegrounds, I think, what was it, 10 battlegrounds he selected, he is going to put his lot in behind Trump. And then you saw his siblings, and there was a selection of siblings and cousins and the like who put out a statement, not particularly pleased with cuz. Gosh, that'll make family lunches at Hyannis Port interesting, won't it?
I've just experienced a burst of hopium with that, and I immediately slap myself around a bit. You know, just the thought of Robert Kennedy being given a position in a Trump administration to look at the effect of the pharmaceutical companies and their cozy ties with the CDC and the effect that's had on taking the American population. I think when Fauci took over at the CDC, about 8% of Americans had a chronic health condition. Now 64% do. And no one seems that curious about why. So the idea that they might start looking at that is so exciting. But at the same time, you think, well, there are hundreds of billions of reasons now to derail Trump and make sure Kamala gets in. And just the thought that, people don't see it. It does make me despair.
Yeah, no, it is kind of scary. And you know, it's not just big pharma in this too. It's big food.
Well, it's big
everything.
Printed money.
Yeah, it is big printed money.
It's big printing money, and the private equity firms who are the same people downstream from it who turn the fake money into real assets. It's going to be interesting. I mean, all I can say to our listeners is thanks for listening, and to our foundation members, thanks so much for your support. And to everyone, I guess just keep, if you find something you enjoy, share it and encourage other people to share it. Because at this point, this stuff sells itself. I mentioned on the Fourth Estate, I was listening to Breakfast the other day, and I forgot that I was listening to RCR for a second. It was the news and then the weather, and I was thinking, this is so good. And then I remembered, oh, it's RCR. It's that best buffet you've ever had after the stale reheated fish and chips.
Yeah. Oh, Ali Leonard. I mean, she's a legend. And Phil Duncan loves it. I mean, WeatherWatch, I've got the app on my phone. I use it all the time. It's so good to have that now. It's really great. And actually, speaking, you've got some really nice feedback with Fourth Estate. I've got some feedback, Martin. Oh. I mean, I love it, the fact now too, that we've sort of solidified that. We've got you, Peter Williams is a regular contributor now, Rachel Stewart. I mean, you guys, the three of you, zing beautifully. And
that was a good old matter.
Yeah, it was brilliant. And even over the weekend with my crazy busy weekend, you'll be pleased to know I had you on the show, Marty. So you're listening to the Fourth Estate. And Liz was just saying three of my faves and loving that lineup. I love this comment on the Fourth Estate. More Marty in asterisk points either side. Please, RCR, listening to the smooth languid tones and new word crafting like midwittery caps off my Friday, from Nikki. Got a fan, Marty.
Actually, I didn't coin the phrase midwittery, Nikki, but I did appropriate it.
Yes. I think that was an Olivia. Was that an Olivia?
No, it's a generally accepted term to describe. It's a summation of the phrase, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing.
I know, she's quite fond of it. I've got one here. Hi, Marie from Tracy. Loving your show. I've listened to Kiwi Farm and love the concept. Good old radio serial. Thank you, Tracy. I hear you and Marty discussing it briefly on your Media Matters segments where you reference some parts from Kiwi Farm and do a quick explain. It would be great to hear a segment, even if it's 5 minutes, possibly even with Marty, behind the scenes of Kiwi Farm to clearly show the inferences and references to current Kiwi life. Love the genre. Whoever is the bright spark and person that came up with that, maybe you. Congratulations. Brilliantly done. Thanks, Tracy.
Well, I can't claim any credit for that, Marie. That's very much your work.
Kiwi Farm. So just a bit of a background on Kiwi Farm, Tracy, is that it started back in October 2021, and I wrote a Facebook post, and it was in direct reaction to the announcement of the compulsory mandates for healthcare workers, primarily because my husband was a healthcare worker. To say I was distraught is an underestimation, because I saw in that moment our entire lives completely changing for us and our family. And I was a mess. I won't lie. I was an absolute mess. And I think that reflects for a lot of people around New Zealand. Now, interestingly enough, only just a few months previously, I had just finished rereading Animal Farm by George Orwell, because I was seeing, everyone was referencing 1984, but I mean, you would have done all well for school, the English, ooh, Marty. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I hadn't read it since then. So I thought, I'm going to read it, because it's not a long book. If you haven't read it, it's, sitting an afternoon in an armchair type read. And I was struck at just the utter brilliance of Orwell and this little novella about a farm. And he was talking about the rise of communism within the Western canon. And here we were again. That's how it started. And of course, initially it was called Aotearoa Farm, because of course we had Jacinda. And so I sort of used those sorts of references. So I wrote it, just a single piece. It was a public post, and it sort of went semi-viral around certain circles there for several weeks. And I copped a little bit of flack here and there. And then I left it until I started this job. I was looking for sort of something that was unique to counterculture and that I'd done and I'd worked. I like a little bit of creative writing. And I suddenly thought, I might just resurrect that and just continue to write on it. So that's what I've done. And of course, things have changed. We've had elections and lots of different elements. So many of the elements of Kiwi Farm now, because the change of the election, have gone. So a lot of the original characters from Orwell's 1984 are no longer there, but the whole concept and the idea is still there. So the fun part for me is creating new characters. Marty chimes in from time to time, and we'll see, particularly the young Te Pāti Māori MPs made perfect attack dogs that Squealer, the puppies that Squealer would take out the back or to indoctrinate. So we pull things in and references, and so that's what we do. So that is Kiwi Farm in a nutshell. And do go back and listen to the earlier ones, because of course those were whilst the Labor government was still in power, and they are probably closer to the original Animal Farm. And if you haven't reread Animal Farm or listened to it on audiobook, which is just as easy, it is well worth it. You'll be stunned. I almost find Animal Farm more on the money sometimes than 1984. So, Alrighty. Right, what else have we got? Oh, Buck. Did you catch Buck? My interview with Buck Angel?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, Buck was great. So we've got an absolute mountain of feedback on Buck, and I'm not going to be able to read all of it because there is so much, but just to give you a wee snippet of what we got, great interview, really doing some good for the younger generation. I remember seeing Buck Angel at Erotica years ago. It's a very, very strange stage show. Yeah, Buck's done a lot of things. It was actually a great interview from Tania, great perspective from another angle, and Buck is confident in himself, but has the courage to voice concerns on different platforms to discourage young people from making irreversible, damaging decisions at a too young age and stage of their lives. Also from Debbie, great interview, handled sensitively and professionally. Sally said an excellent listen, and Rochelle said, thanks for Marie for an interesting interview with Buck. Yeah, it was, Buck was fantastic. So if you didn't catch that one, catch it on our replays over on the app. Just put in Buck Angel and it's from last week. Very, very good. Any final thoughts before we close, Marty?
No, just buckle up, I think, and make sure you've got things that you're doing to keep yourself centered and pulling your family closer and getting your act together and building up your resilience.
And your fourth estating, of course, again, noon on Friday.
I've got another week of overexposure. I'm on the political panel as well, and the fourth estate. So, yeah, there's plenty of Marty to go around this week.
Yeah, Marty Friday. I think we love the double Marty on a Friday.
Oh, well, there's so much to talk about, isn't there? So, and such a clear distinction between what we're doing and what the legacy media are doing, and as I said, I had that soaring, dawning understanding last week. My gosh, you know, we might actually, you know, we're making something that's better than the legacy media. We've just got to hold our nerve, keep going, and build the audience. So, you know, if you can join as a foundation member, and if you can forward articles and programs that you find are useful, that's all really helpful. Let's all do this together.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally couldn't agree more, my friend. So thank you very much. We will do this all again. And if you want to send any of that in, your thoughts, anything, 2057 is the text number, and inbox@realitycheck.radio is the email. So thank you.
Thanks very much, Marie.
I'll talk to you next week. Cheers.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.